Hello and welcome to CEO Guru on the BBC World Service with me, Steve Tappin. I'm an entrepreneur and management coach. I specialise in coaching and advising chief executives from all over the world. In this programme, the producer Neil Koenig and I will be looking at what happens to leadership in business when East meets West.
Today is different from the East to the West. We'll bring the soil of life, water of purity and a seed of hope.
It's July the 27th, 2012, the day before the London Olympics begins. At Lancaster House in central London, the British government is hosting China Business Day, a grand event where business execs from East and West can mingle, talk shop and do deals. One of the highlights is an outdoor fashion show combined with a curious sort of ceremony.
We'll sow the seeds by mixing water with soil. This represents the various cycle of life and the perpetual flow of human progress.
But there's a strange twist. While most of the fashion models are glamorous professionals, a few of them are not.
And now, with an even warmer round of applause, let's welcome Mr. Liu Chuanzhi, Chairman of China Entrepreneur Club and Chairman President of Legend Holdings.
Also on the catwalk are a group of middle-aged men. They are some of the most powerful business leaders in China. It's a bizarre sight, something I could never have imagined happening just a few years ago when I first began to work with Chinese business leaders. But maybe China's CEOs have something to be confident about. China now has the world's second biggest economy. Asian companies are in a prime position to take advantage of any boom in the region. By contrast, Western businesses are nervous. For decades, they've been used to being the top dog. But now, growth in the West has stalled. Western CEOs see the gold rush happening in Asia, and they're panicking about being left out.
I worry that the West, which led the world in dreaming and innovation and excitement and adventure, has lulled itself into a sense of being okay. I don't think we dream big enough. We need to catch up.
In this BBC World Service programme, we'll look at the rise of business in China since the fundamental economic reforms of the 1980s. We'll be trying to learn something about the hopes and dreams of this new generation of Chinese business leaders. We'll ask if their extraordinary ambitions are realistic and if their Western counterparts are right to be worried. The leader of the Chinese delegation at the Lancaster House event is Liu Chuanzhi, founder of Legend Holdings, a giant conglomerate. Legend includes Lenovo, which is now one of the largest computer companies in the world. Many in the technology industry were shocked when Lenovo bought IBM's PC division just a few years ago. To Western ears, Mr. Liu's ambitions for his enterprise may sound staggering.
The vision of Legend Holdings is to become an industry in its own right. I want Legend to become the top enterprise across all industries, not only in China, but in the whole world.
Despite Liu Chuanzhi's modest ambitions, it's worth remembering that his business has grown from one employing a handful of people to being one of the world's largest companies in around 25 years. But Liu Chuanzhi is not the only Chinese business leader with big ideas. Zhang Lan is the founder of the South Beauty chain of restaurants.
My dream is to let the people of the world change their impressions of Chinese food. I want to show them how beautiful and delicious Chinese cuisine can be, and let them know that they will enjoy and really like it. And in 20 years, my plan is to lead my business into one of the 500 strongest companies in the world.
This is the kind of talk that spreads alarm among CEOs in the West. As the economy expands in China and the new middle class with growing spending power emerges, there'll be more and more opportunities for Chinese entrepreneurs to tap into this and build huge businesses. Some of these companies could then go global, vying for the markets that Western companies view as their own. Zhu Guofan has made and lost and made again fortunes from running chains of foot massage establishments across China. He's one of many Chinese company founders who now have their eyes on the next stage of their country's development as the economy shifts from focusing on manufacturing and exports to catering more to the consumer needs of its own people.
I think that in the Western world, about 80% of industries are in services, but in China, it's only about 40%. So we have a huge space to expand. We've got 1.3 billion people here, so there's an enormous potential market ahead. I read a book about the founder of a company called National in Japan, and he said he hired 200,000 employees. That's my dream. I want to hire 200,000 workers of my own.
The scale of the ambition of Chinese business leaders, like the ones we've just heard, is acting as a wake-up call to some of their Western counterparts. Joe Plumeri is CEO of global insurance broker Willis.
I don't think we dream big enough. We need to catch up. And I worry that the West, which led the world in dreaming and innovation and excitement and adventure, has lulled itself to a sense of being okay. You can see it in people. They don't strive like they used to strive. I remember I was running in a 5K race with my granddaughter. I think we came in 180th. But we got a participation medal. I said, you know, when I was her age, 10 years old, you either won or you lost. People even today think they ought to be paid for effort rather than results, and you get confused about that stuff. And I think that you got to learn from that, and you got to understand that there are other parts of the world that have looked upon what was great and said, that's average, and now we're going to exceed that.
China's transformation over the last 30 years has been astonishing. But when we look at the emergence of a new breed of confident Chinese CEOs and entrepreneurs, it can sometimes be easy to forget the powerful influence that the past still has. One thing that sets Chinese bosses apart from business leaders elsewhere in the world is the impact that communist rule in the country has had since the end of World War II. For a long period, commercial activity, as known in the West, almost stopped altogether. It didn't start up again on a large scale until government-led economic reforms began in the late 1970s and early 80s. David Roach is founder of Independent Strategy, an investment advisory firm based in London and Hong Kong. He's observed the Chinese business scene develop for many years.
China did not have the monolithic state-owned enterprises which Russia had. It was always local enterprise, but it was communized and controlled by one bit of the state or the other. So you actually had a gap for 40 years, and then you find that the whole nature of business globally has changed. You're actually on the cusp of the takeoff of globalization, because it's actually the liberalization of 1.2 billion people in China, or a bit less in those days, which was the tremendous push, together with the internet and electronics and all the rest, to change the global business model. But of course, you hadn't had a business model for 45 years. So you started off the new business era at a distinct disadvantage in many ways, and one great advantage, which was you had a blank sheet of paper to write on.
The absence of a commercial culture or any examples of other entrepreneurs meant that those interested in starting a company would have to be prepared to start from scratch and invent their own approach. Let's examine the journey of one of these trailblazers in more detail. The story of Lenovo founder Leo Trangieur is emblematic of many others who tried to establish businesses in China after China opened up. As I know from my own experience, when starting a company, you don't only need money and freedom to take decisions, you also need freedom to think widely and creatively about your business proposition. Leo Trangieur says that 30 years ago, the system in China didn't make any of these things easy to do.
People were the docile instruments of the Communist Party. This was as a result of the education that people of my generation always had at that time. But although my university degree was in science, ever since childhood I liked reading history, literature and philosophy and other subjects. I enjoyed questioning and thinking for myself.
Leo Trenger is unusual amongst prominent Chinese business leaders for being prepared to speak his mind in public about controversial matters such as politics. When he worked as a scientific researcher, he says he found the system stifling.
Before I started the company, I was a member of the scientific and technical staff of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, focusing on technology. At that time, what puzzled me was that after I achieved a scientific or technical result, I would put it aside and find another one. Discoveries would never be turned into products or money. In fact, no contribution was made to society. This was a big puzzle to me.
Leo Trenger often wondered how he could solve this riddle. Inspiration came after the president of the academy, the famous scientist Zhou Guanzhao, talked about his experiences in America, where entrepreneurs would often exploit scientific discoveries by launching new products and new companies.
After listening to what he said, I thought I would be very glad to take on the role of being an entrepreneur. As the risk of failure was very high, and most of the other scientists had not undertaken such a job yet, none of them wanted to do it. But I wanted to stand out. I wanted to be someone who plans to go into business and establishes an enterprise as he sees fit. Most of the other scientists were afraid of doing this, but I was glad to take on such a task.
Leo Trenger says it wasn't only the fear of failure that held others back. At the time, people who were involved in starting businesses were looked down upon. However, Mr. Leo persevered. He succeeded in obtaining permission from the Academy's management to start a technology company and was allowed much freedom in decision-making. But he still found himself in a less fortunate position than some other state-backed enterprises.
Let me give you an example. It was still the era of the planned economy in China at the time, and the government only gave production and import and export approvals to those enterprises that it closely controlled. Only these companies could import components and get discounts in foreign currency. Those out of its management control, like my company, couldn't get any such privileges.
Leo Trenger eventually succeeded in setting his Lenovo computer company on the path to spectacular growth. You're listening to CEO Guru on the BBC World Service with me, Steve Tappin. And we're looking at what happens to leadership in business when East meets West. We've heard about the struggles that Leo Trenger had whilst he was establishing his giant computer company Lenovo in 1980s China, when starting a business was considered a really bold idea. But in one important respect, Lenovo was unusual, and like many other Chinese firms, it was not a family business. In Asia, as in many other parts of the world, it can be difficult to raise money to start a company, so financial backing from friends and relatives is an absolutely crucial source of startup capital for fledgling businesses. This backing can come with strings, but also with extra support and commitment too. Leo Trenger views this family approach to business so positively, he wants to instill it within the vast Lenovo Corporation, which is not family owned.
I'd like to turn this into a family-run company without the family. What I mean by that is the company should be as long-lasting as a family-run business, but without the actual blood ties. This vision could be made a reality by creating the right organizational structure and business culture.
But although Leo Trenger may want his giant company to be guided by family values, he'd probably also be the first to say that any business should be run in a professional manner. Investment advisor David Roach says that if Chinese and Asian companies want to compete successfully on the global stage, then family interests may be forced to take more of a back seat.
If you're going to run a meritocracy based on assessment of people and promotion of people, then you have a completely different type of company to the company in which the family is there for the family. Now, of course, go back to the Industrial Revolution here or anywhere else. It was very much the model here. but it's a model which passes its use-by date, because the next generation will probably be richer, lazier, less motivated, much more interested in going to Harvard and having a hell of a good time than actually staying and making textiles for sale to the West in China. And that reduces the amount of sacrifice you're prepared to make. It also means that the sons and daughters won't want to follow in daddy's footsteps. There's no need to. They've got enough money once he dies to do anything they want. And so at that point in time, you actually have to professionalize the company. You have to change the management style. You have to bring in outside people, which means you have to let go. And that's the point we're at.
One Asian entrepreneur who has reevaluated the traditional family-based approach to business is Ho Kwon Ping. Mr. Ho is the founder of the Banyan Tree luxury resort chain, which has headquarters in Singapore. Ho Kwon Ping studied at Stanford University in California. Several years later, after his father became ill, he joined the family firm. He says he quickly realised that things needed to change in the business.
The primary thing that we were doing, which I felt was not viable, and which today remains to me in many ways the curse of Asian businesses, was contract manufacturing. We were essentially a subcontractor, a supplier to other people. So we would make shoes for Nike and Adidas. We assembled television sets for other brands. You never owned the market. You never owned the brand. So therefore, you are always like people producing for Walmart. The margins are squeezed all the time. I felt that this was not ever going to be viable. And I had my epiphany, essentially, when I started a shoes company and closed it within a year, because we set up in Thailand, Indonesia became cheaper. And this was before China became the juggernaut that sort of came along and steamrolled everybody with its low cost. Then I made the clear decision that essentially we had to get out of all of this, and we had to have a proprietary advantage, not a relative advantage. See, a cost is a relative advantage. If you're cheaper than somebody else, it's totally relative. So what is a proprietary advantage? In my view, there's only two things. You own the brand, or you own technology. You create something, you patent it. So essentially, I decided we had to have a brand.
The Banyan Tree Resort brand that Ho Kwon Ping went on to establish now operates in 27 countries. There are signs that other Asian business leaders are now taking a similar approach to that of Mr. Ho. Xia Hua is the founder of Yi Fashion Group, which is based in Beijing. The company's designs were on display at the fashion show at Lancaster House. Xia Hua talks about her business experience with passion, and she says she tries to put a lot of this into her company's image and into its products. She calls her approach emotional marketing.
I always remember that a customer's heart is close to a customer's wallet. For I'm not interested in where a customer's hands and eyes are. I'm more concerned about where his heart is. If we're just running a business, for example, selling clothes, then I think it's very simple. There's such a huge consumer market in China, so someone might buy your product because of one aspect that attracts him, and then leave and move on. I often call this a one-night stand. But the most important thing is to create a brand that isn't just about that random encounter. It should be about lasting mutual attraction. A customer should not be a one-night stand, but more a lover who constantly thinks of you and cares about you and will give you ever afterwards their purchasing loyalty.
It remains to be seen whether or not Asian companies are capable of creating a large number of world-beating brands and products, like Western companies have successfully done. But the more Chinese and other Asian companies question their traditional approach to business, and the more skillful and professional they become, the more that rivals in other parts of the world have to fear. What do Western leaders make of the aspirations of their Asian counterparts? Sir Martin Sorrell is the founder of global advertising giant WPP. He believes that many Western CEOs do not look far enough ahead, and they could learn a lot from their Asian peers.
It's not about the short term. When you go to Russia, the Russians openly admit that they're very short term in their thinking. And they say that one of the big problems in Russia is making people much longer term in thinking. With the Chinese, maybe because, you know, 100 years is a short period for them, a lot of Chinese believe what's been happening in the last couple of years is just a blip in history, and now they're back in their rightful position, which I'm sure they will eclipse the United States or be equal to the United States in pretty short order. So people think of them as being traders. Actually, I'm not. They're investors and builders. They're interested in building long-term successful enterprises. They're not worried about short-term reversals or short-term bumpiness.
So what do Chinese CEOs believe they can learn from the West? And what do they think the West can learn from them? Leo Tranger from Lenovo again.
Westerners have had a stable life for a very long time, so generally they have less drive to succeed than the Chinese. But to put it in Chinese words, Chinese entrepreneurs can eat big hardships. China, of course, needs to learn from the West, because in the West they have strict rules and regulations. They also have a deeper and more delicate understanding of the law governing the creation and running of companies.
Many Western business leaders remain worried about what they see as the threat of fierce competition from Asian and Chinese companies. David Roche of Independent Strategy says it's important to keep a certain perspective.
We're all overscared. Remember that a 1% increase in GDP per capita in Germany, for example, is equal to a 10% increase in GDP per capita in China, because one is big and the other is small. So the numbers game of seeing China always increasing by 8, 10% GDP growth per year is actually not scary in reality, because if Germany is doing 1%, it's keeping the gap open. The gap should close, but how the gap closes is going to be much slower than people expect. And it's going to be because China will grow domestically, not killing our industries, but by actually sucking in more products from us. That for us is an opportunity, not a threat. The threat would be if it continued to be a manufacturing export-based economy, which would progressively put us all out of work. But actually, China has passed the point of maximum threat. It now has to change its economic model completely for its own good.
If leaders of Western companies are going to prosper in the East, they've got to understand the evolving business environment in Asia, while at the same time better understand how to connect to Asian business leaders. The same applies to Asian leaders. They must learn about Western business practices and what makes their Western counterparts tick. Most CEOs from both the East and the West recognize they need to adapt how they work. But in reality, they underestimate the differences in mindset, cultures, and working practices. Unless they can address this, then conflicts will arise and growth and significant business opportunities could be lost.